Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. They may be closed, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. jackandrea.com. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am very excited to be speaking today on the morning show with Steve Bennin, a producer for the Rachel Maddow Show on MSNBC and the author of a book we're going to be discussing today called The Imposters: How the Republicans Quit Governing and Hijacked American Politics. It is Mr. Bennin's contention that the Republican Party, by and large, has largely abdicated our sort of standard traditional notions of what it means to govern and how a major political party is intended to function. And he also contends that this has been the case even before the inauguration of Donald Trump, our current president. So he lays some historical context on how, in his view, the Republican Party has come to this. And in a sense, has betrayed its own proud history as a party that has at many points in its history been responsible for significant policy. He feels that that's largely absent from what they are about at the moment, and he analyzes that thoroughly in his book and over a whole plethora of different major policy issues and concerns. The book is published by William Morrow, again titled The Imposters: How the Republicans Quit Governing and Hijacked American Politics. And Steve Bennin, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I really appreciate this opportunity to speak with you. Right off the bat, I hope you won't mind if we spend just a couple of minutes talking about the fact that you are, as I said, a producer for the Rachel Maddow Show on MSNBC. For the sake of any of our listeners who watch that program and might be curious, as I am, what is it that you do as a producer for that program? Is it glamorous, exciting work? And is it work that most of us would understand and appreciate?
It's interesting because in large part because we have a large staff, and that includes a lot of producers who have different responsibilities on the show. We have booking producers. We have segment producers. I'm what's called a digital producer, which means that I write for the Rachel Maddow Show's blog. It's called Maddow Blog, which is found at msnbc.com/Maddow Blog. And so I write and publish daily commentary and analysis on current events and political developments. And then we use that content frequently we incorporate that content into the broadcast, and various things that I write about end up on the show. And that's my role in the operation. I can't speak to whether or not it's glamorous. I will leave that to others to decide. But it's certainly very rewarding, and I enjoy it very much. I've been doing it now for a little over 8 years.
And could you say the term again, what kind of producer you are? I didn't quite catch the word.
Sure, it's a digital producer.
Digital producer.
Yes, because I'm producing content online.
Very good. And it turns out then that question that I feared was off topic in terms of your book is probably actually not off topic at all, because I assume then that this book springs very naturally, very organically, out of the work that you do for the Rachel Maddow Show on a daily basis.
You're exactly right. I think for a lot of authors, especially writing about nonfiction, you start with a research assistant. I was able to just start with my archive because I've been writing about these issues in an episodic way every day for over a decade. And so I was able to draw upon that content when putting the pieces of the puzzle together to write this book. And so, yes, one led very naturally to the other.
And for you to be able to write a book like this, does it mean that Rachel Maddow has to sign off on it as a good idea, or the folks at MSNBC, or is this, in a sense, part and parcel of your function with the program and with the network?
Well, I've been very fortunate working with Rachel. She's a dear friend, in addition to the fact that she's my employer. And she and I have been talking about this thesis back and forth professionally and personally just for years, just kicking it around and bouncing ideas off of one another. And so she was very encouraging when I told her that I wanted to pursue this. Once the book was written, I had to give it to the network, the lawyers, network standards to sign off, of course, which is kind of a standard process for anyone who works at a major network like this. They've been supportive as well. And so it all came together quite nicely.
Very good. Probably one matter that we should take care of right off the bat, because I think it's going to make a big difference in how people listen to this interview and or keep their radios on or turn the radio off, is I think we need to make sure that people understand what this book is not. Because I think someone could glance at the title and subtitle and assume that this is a book about how Republicans are dumb and Democrats are smart, or Republicans are evil and Democrats are good, or substitute conservatives and liberals for those two terms. And I think that kind of assumption does a profound disservice to the book that you have written here and what this book is about. So explain how your book is not at all that simplistic summary that I just laid out.
Well, I'm glad you said that. I went out of my way. I made a conscious effort not to be a polemicist, because I feel like there are plenty of polemicists out there and I don't want to be one of them. I feel like my book is sober in tone. It is intended to be policy focused, substantively focused, because I feel like these are important issues. The challenges facing the nation are too important to be reduced to name calling and pettiness. I feel like there are important tasks to be done, and the way to get those tasks done is to take governing seriously, to take policymaking seriously. And I wrote about the book in large part because I want to challenge Republicans to be a governing party again. You know, I grew up in the 1980s, and while I had issues with the Reagan administration when I was junior high school age, I recognized the fact that Reagan and his party were a governing party at the time. There were serious debates about whether those ideas had value and merit, but they were governing. They attempted to use the levers of power in responsible ways to achieve meaningful goals. And I feel like Republicans have strayed from that tradition, but it doesn't have to be that way. And so I wrote this book not to engage in name calling or to point fingers, but to challenge Republicans to recognize their roots and to get back to the business of state. I hope that they take me up on the challenge.
The way you phrased that makes it sound like you honestly, sincerely hope, and perhaps on some level intend, for Republicans to read this book. I mean, this is not a book that was written to make Democrats feel smug and satisfied. This is a book, in a sense, written for maybe a given Republican who might feel some dismay over the way their own party has been conducting itself in contrast to the way they once conducted themselves. Would that be a fair statement?
Absolutely. I mean, I concede the point that Republicans do not, this is not a flattering portrayal of Republican politics. And so I imagine that there will be some who read this book or learn about this book. And if they are diehard Republicans, if they are diehard Donald Trump supporters, they will immediately take offense. And they will see this assessment as being mean-spirited, perhaps, or being at least at a minimum, highly unflattering, of course. And there are Democrats who maybe take issue with Donald Trump and his party and will read this book and feel a degree of satisfaction knowing or getting the sense that my indictment rings true to them. And that's fine. But at the same time, I believe in a Madisonian system of government. The system requires two governing parties challenging each other, testing each other's assumptions, questioning each other, pushing each other to be better. And we do not have that right now. In my book, I argue that really we have one governing party and one what I call post-policy party, and by that I mean they have abandoned the pretense that governing is important and policymaking is important. And that to me leads to a breakdown. Our political system cannot and will not and should not function with one party that cares about governing and one party that does not. And so ideally, what I'd like to see happen is for my book to be part of a conversation that inspires Republicans to change course. I think that everyone would be better off, including Republicans, if they do change course and begin anew to take policymaking seriously.
And to be clear, what you are suggesting is not, for instance, that you want the Republican Party to suddenly see the world the way you do, or Rachel right. Maddow does. It's not that you want the Republicans to tilt towards the left or embrace certain policies that, for instance, you feel make sense. This is not about that kind of difference. It's about another kind of difference that in some ways is even more profound.
I hope so. I mean, I will acknowledge the fact that I believe that I could look at things from a center-left perspective. I make no secret of that. I think that center-left solutions are on the merits probably better on most instances than center-right solutions, and that's fine. But that's a different kind of debate. I'm not saying that Republicans are wrong on the issues. I'm saying they're wrong about in how they go about addressing issues. The breakdown happens when they are crafting ideas, evaluating them, scrutinizing them, approving them, and trying to implement them. That's where the breakdown happens in Republican politics, and as I argue in the book, and that's where I feel like they need to change course, not right. ideologically necessarily, but in the pragmatic approach to problem solving.
Right. At one point in the book, I think you put it so very well when you say the two parties are not just offering different answers, they're asking entirely different kinds of questions. So in other words, you're not asking the Republicans to offer the same answers that, for instance, make sense to you. It's much earlier in the process, before we're even getting to the answers, it's about the questions and what questions matter.
Exactly. There is a process. There is a process through which policy is made. Take any issue under the sun, and we can think about how it should work and it used to work in Congress. There'd be lawmakers introduce a bill, they go to committee hearings, they work out the unglamorous tasks of rolling up one's sleeves and getting into the nitty-gritty of policy and work towards a goal. And then you'd have debate and you'd have compromises and you'd have town hall hearings and you'd work with stakeholders, and it's a process through which policy is made. None of that's happening right now. And in Republican politics, it hasn't happened for the better part of a decade. And to my mind, that is the it's not just a breakdown. That's the first word that comes to mind, is a breakdown. But in addition to that, it's a crisis of sorts, because in our system, when one party isn't governing and they're in positions of authority, there are obvious problems that start to unfold. They're not necessarily completing the tasks they've been given, and they're not compromising, and they're not implementing policy in a way that serves the public good. That's what I hope to see Republicans change.
A last kind of introductory question. At some point, I believe in the first chapter, you say, this book is intended as a lens, L-E-N-S. Explain what you mean by that, the kind of lens that this book is meant to be.
You know, I Rachel and I have talked about this many times. I think everyone sees current events through a lens, whether it be ideological, whether it be political, whether it be spiritual, whatever it may be, people see events through a lens. This is my lens. This is the lens through which I see current events. When I'm looking at, for example, the crisis with the coronavirus pandemic, in recent months, we've seen breakdowns in governance as it relates to the federal response to the coronavirus. I see that through the lens of someone who worries about governing, and sees it through the lens of someone who believes that Republicans are failing when it comes to governing. The same is true on recent events with regards to social justice protests. I see that through the lens of policy. I see that through the lens of officials who are failing to exercise their authority responsibly and use the levers of government to achieve meaningful ends. That it is the lens through which I see current events. And so my hope is that perhaps that people will read my book and be able to see events through the same lens, be able to appreciate it through that thesis, if you will. That is how I intended the book to be structured, as a way of letting people in on my lens. That's kind of how I went about the process.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Steve Bannon, who is a producer, a digital producer for The Rachel Maddow Show on MSNBC. But more to the point for today's morning show, he is the author of a book called The Imposters: How the Republicans Quit Governing and Hijacked American Politics. It is his contention that the Republican Party, as it is currently functioning, has largely abandoned the most basic notions of what a major political party does, namely govern, in favor of simply securing and holding on to political power. At one point, I don't know if you've coined this term, but you certainly use the term frequently in the book, a post-policy party. Explain what is behind those intriguing words.
Well, to my mind, there are governing parties and there are post-policy parties, and they are mirror opposites. A governing party takes data seriously and evidence and values the importance of expertise, and they think through how ideas should be implemented and crafted. They start with a question and work towards an answer, as opposed to the other way around. To my mind, a post-policy party is the opposite. They abandon the pretense that governing is important. They ignore experts. They find no real value in data and evidence. They start with an answer and work backwards from there. So to my mind, that encapsulates, to my mind, where Republicans are right now. They are a post-policy party insofar as they no longer value the importance of policymaking and the substance of government.
And I think you also talk about how the matter of crafting real policy is something that you describe at one point as tiresome and unglamorous work. And probably anybody who is engaged in it would not argue with you. And so I think one of the things you're saying in this book is that at least much of the current Republican Party has absolutely no interest in that tiresome and unglamorous work.
We've seen that repeatedly, I think, in recent years, but it's certainly true in the Donald Trump era. You know, we look, for example, at 2017, when the GOP leaders and GOP officials got together to work on healthcare reform, for example. They crafted a regressive bill, a narrowly tailored bill. They did so in private, and then decided to just vote on it without any real scrutiny, without any congressional hearings, without hearing from experts or stakeholders. They just jumped to the end of the process without having done the real hard work. We can contrast that with how Democrats approved the Affordable Care Act. Now, we can debate the merits of the ACA and whether it's perfect or not. I think it's fair to say no one really sees it as perfect, but the process through which it was approved was thorough. It took a year. There were dozens of congressional hearings. There were across two chambers. There was endless hours of debate and scrutiny. And that is how a bill should happen. That is how policy should be made. And we can contrast that with how Republicans approached healthcare reform in a way that I think that defines post-policy politics. They were indifferent to how the bills should be made. We saw it again later that year when it came to tax reform. Now, we can have a debate as to whether or not it's worthwhile to cut taxes for the wealthy and expect prosperity to flow from that. But that's not the debate I'm talking about in the book. The debate I'm talking about in the book is how that tax bill was made and how that tax bill was passed. Again, no congressional hearings, no scrutiny, no congressional budget office scoring. They didn't care because they started with the answer, which is, we'll just cut taxes for the wealthy and big corporations. And that's the only answer that they needed. And so they proceeded from there with no real process, with no real interest in governing. And so that is at the heart of the thesis. That is the driving point of the book.
Not to jump ahead, but later in the book, you talk about foreign policy. And it seems to me that a very good corollary to what you just described would be President Trump's face-to-face meeting with the leader of North Korea. And the fact that under more kind of typical circumstances, there would be all kinds of behind the scenes diplomacy going on, which would ultimately climax in that photo op in which you have these two leaders ready to sign off on some sort of significant agreement that had been hammered out in that tiresome and unglamorous work that we were talking about earlier. And instead, the choice was made to, in a sense, jump to the photo op with nothing really in place. And of course, ultimately, there was very little, if anything, to show for it in terms of what that face-to-face meeting really meant.
No, this is a classic example. I think, and I'm glad that you emphasize that, because I kind of feel like when you look at the Trump era and foreign policy, this is a perfect example. Because, as you note, we can all in our minds imagine how in a traditional environment and traditional administration, how something like this would unfold. There'd be endless weeks and months of this unglamorous roll up your sleeves work of diplomats and ambassadors and State Department officials and national security officials, and they'd be discussing the details of how would this meeting unfold and what would the meeting be about and what does one hope to achieve from it? All of that was skipped. Donald Trump liked the idea of putting on a spectacle. He was playing the role not of a president, but of a television producer, imagining how things should play out on television and before the cameras. And so, right, we look, and if we look at the end game, what were the results of this after Donald Trump said he didn't need to prepare for the summit? He didn't need to do any of the legwork. He didn't have to do any of the thought process as it relates to policymaking. Just jump to the end. Well, how did that work out? Well, we see the results. It was just recently that North Korea literally blew up a diplomatic office as part of this breakdown in the process of diplomacy. And we can draw a direct line between Donald Trump's inability to take the process seriously and the failure of the policy itself. This is the inevitable result of a post-policy approach. It is the inevitable result of when officials are put in a position in which they have to take governing seriously and then they don't, it leads inevitably to failure.
Right. I'm trying to anticipate the way someone might react to this conversation and to your central point. There are probably listeners who would, in a sense, view that tiresome, laborious process differently than you do. As I'm thinking about that, I'm reminded of a recent interview with an author about a book about Amazon and how Amazon functions, and the fact that Jeff Bezos, among other things, has tried to create a scenario in which significant questions get answered by a very small group of people, and he tries to make the process very lean and to some extent at least really quick and so on. I mean, trying to create efficiency. And I think when we talk about a tiresome, unglamorous process that often takes a long time, it sounds like slow work that slows the work of government, that makes things harder than they need to be. And some people would see what you are describing as a crisis as just a quicker and simpler way of doing the business of government. How would you respond to somebody reacting to this in that way?
Well, two things. Well, the first is, it would be preferable to have a quick, streamlined governing process where we didn't necessarily have to care about the details and we didn't have to care about the scrutiny and the analysis. We could just say, well, X and Y and Z sound like good ideas. Let's just do that. I can appreciate the appeal. Of course, that seems like a great idea. I would prefer it, of course. The problem is, that governing is complex. We have a $14 trillion economy. We are the global preeminent superpower on Earth. We have extraordinary responsibilities around the world as it relates to diplomacy and national security and the economy and public health. Across the board, these are complex issues. And so, which leads me to my second point, which is, if we want things to be done well, if we want things to work, we have to take the time to do them right. I imagine if you and I were sitting down and neither one of us necessarily has a background in space engineering, let's say, and you and I decided we were going to try and build a lunar module, you and me. Well, now you and I have no background in science or space or really anything outside of political science. You and I might sit down and say, well, we've seen some movies about space and we can just sketch out what we think a lunar module should look like. And we could just try and implement that because, well, we're good-natured people and we have America's best interests at heart. We just do that. Well, if we don't do the work, that lunar module is not going to go very well. That process will fail. That will not produce results that satisfy anyone or do anyone any good. And so I'm sympathetic to those who want a streamlined process. But at the same time, we have to recognize that in order to do complex work well, it requires the laborious work. It requires people who are patient, who care about policy, who care about the details, to actually go through the trouble. I think that often in Congress in particular, and sometimes at the state level, but particularly in Congress and perhaps in the White House, there is a temptation to go into punditry, that there are politicians who enjoy appearing perhaps on shows like yours or on cable news, like shows like the ones I work for. They like the idea of pontificating. They want to share their thoughts. But while I can appreciate that, I am in fact being a pundit literally right now, I also recognize that there is a difference between punditry and policymaking. Mm. That if someone wants to run for Congress, they can't just want to appear on television all the time or on radio shows like yours all the time. They have to go and actually do their jobs, which entails, I'm afraid, unglamorous governing. I think too often we see a breakdown there because there are too many people who prefer being pundits to being policymakers.
Hmm. Just to stay with the Amazon parallel for a moment, one of the other things that was made, a point made in that book was Jeff Bezos likes to characterize Amazon as something like the best place on earth to make mistakes. I mean, it's a place where, I mean, he has tried to design it where he does not want his people to be afraid of making mistakes, and so cautious about avoiding them that you end up not accomplishing anything at all. It occurs to me that in a sense, if you're going to be sloppy about policy, you in a sense are adopting a similar understanding that making mistakes is not the worst thing in the world. And if you're too scared of mistakes, it just slows you down. But on the flip side, as you described how formidable the United States is on the world scene, when we make mistakes, we meaning when our government makes a mistake, it can have colossal, perhaps even catastrophic consequences. That's a big difference.
Exactly right. I mean, the work that we're talking about here when it comes to governing is important. It has consequences. It affects people. It's not an abstraction. There are real world consequences for Americans and for people around the world, given our dominant role. There is a cause and effect, and we have to think those things through. And in order to think those things through, we need to care. We need to appreciate and recognize the value of details and think these things through and move beyond just what sounds good or what's ideologically satisfying or what makes for a good hashtag on Twitter. Like, those are trivialities. those aren't important. Those are unimportant considerations that have no real consequences, and prioritizing those over real world consequences is a mistake.
Hmm. We're speaking with Steve Bannon, and he is a producer for the Rachel Maddow Show on NBC and the author of a book we are discussing today called The Imposters: How the Republicans Quit Governing and Hijacked American Politics. And I want to make sure that this clarification is part of our conversation. When you say how the Republicans quit governing, I don't think you mean Republicans across the country.
No, on the contrary. I don't think of it as Republican voters as having failed in this regard. I think of the people that they've elected as having failed in this regard.
Right.
It's Republican officials. And, you know, I make a point in the book to kind of identify the culprits as best I can, so that people know exactly that who I'm referring to. GOP voters, I think, want what's best for the country and care a lot about how policies affect them and their families. I'm principally concerned with Republican officials, most notably those in Washington, who I feel are failing on the job.
At one point early in the book, you quote a member of the faculty of the University of Pennsylvania, John DiIulio. I forget what he was brought on board by the Bush administration to study, but he became very disenchanted by what he saw. And I believe it was him who coined the term Mayberry Machiavellis.
Yes, that's right.
Can you explain what is behind those intriguing words?
Right. So, yes, John DiIulio is a political scientist at University of Pennsylvania. He was brought on to be the head of the faith-based office in the Bush-Cheney White House. So his task was to help implement a system in which the government would use taxpayer funds to finance religious services for people in need. And DiIulio was a believer in the process and the project, and he is a renowned political scientist in his own right. To make no mistake, he is not post-policy in his orientation. Mm-hmm. So he arrives at the White House early in George W. Bush's first term, and he starts to realize that there are far too many in the White House who are principally concerned with politics and only politics. What will help the president win re-election? What will help Republican candidates in their various elections? And that was the only thing that they were concerned about. And so he thought of it. I don't want to speak for John DiIulio, but the way he described it in his work was that these were Machiavellian in nature insofar as they only cared about politics. But then there was a Mayberry quality to it, because I think that some of them were from Texas and the South, and they had this good-natured Machiavellian nature to their work. And so he coined that phrase, which was very memorable. And I reference in the book to demonstrate the origins of the problem. I mean, John DiIulio was one of the first to really shine a light on those who prioritize politics over policy, and who prioritizing ideological concerns over policymaking concerns. And so my argument is that while John DiIulio was concerned about this early on in the Bush presidency, the Bush-Cheney presidency, the years that soon followed, with the election of Barack Obama, for example, and then on to Donald Trump, it was that small problem intensified. You just adding steroids to a small problem became a much larger problem, to the point that it is now, to my mind, a systemic problem.
So this did not start with the election of Barack Obama. This was already an issue in your mind, but it certainly, in your mind, ratcheted in intensity, in severity, with the election of Barack Obama. You quote, go ahead.
I was just going to say, the Barack Obama election, to me, was the crossroads for Republican politics, because it was at that point where they had just suffered two very significant electoral defeats in a row between the 2006 and 2008 cycle. And that was the point at which I thought that Republicans needed to take stock and settle on what were their priorities going to be, what kind of policies would they pursue, what would their platform be, what would their agenda be. It was at that point, however, that I feel like Republican leaders got together and decided that they were going to be against whatever Barack Obama was for. And that, to me, was the real turning point as it relates to making that shift from governing party to post-policy party. I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Please continue.
That's fine. You quote Mitch McConnell.
Yes.
And many people remember this statement that he made, saying not long after Barack Obama was elected president, the single most important thing we want to achieve is for President Obama to be a one-term president. Now, there are probably Democrats who believe the same thing right now, that the most important thing is for Donald Trump to be a one-term president. But you see something a little more insidious about the way Mitch McConnell was saying that, and saying it so proudly at that moment.
I do. I see this as one of the most important quotes of our era, because it was Mitch McConnell in his capacity as the Senate Republican leader. So he had a great many constituents to think about. He had his own constituents in Kentucky to think about. He had a national constituency insofar as he's the leader of his caucus in the Senate. And we were in a time of crisis. At the time he said it, we had rising unemployment, nearly as high as it is right now. We had crises in the Middle East. It was an important moment in American governance, and it was necessary. And Americans, I think, were looking to officials in Washington to come together and start solving problems. We had a lot on our plates in 2009, and I think that there was a feeling that Americans really needed to come together and start rolling up our sleeves and getting things done. And Mitch McConnell basically said, no. Mitch McConnell said, I don't think that should be the priority. That policymaking is fine and governing is okay, but for Mitch McConnell, what was really important above all else, the only consideration that really rises to the top of his list, was defeating Barack Obama. And so as a result of that assumption or that proposition, he made policy, political decisions and policy decisions accordingly. He wouldn't compromise with the Obama White House on literally any issue. If there was an issue in which Obama and McConnell agreed, McConnell would change his opinion in order to make sure that Barack Obama didn't get a victory or have any success. And so it created an untenable dynamic that we were not accustomed to seeing in the United States. You know, when Robert Dole was the Senate majority, Senate Republican leader in the early 1990s, working with a Democratic White House, Dole and Clinton would sit down and negotiate. There was policymaking that was done in the 1990s. Similarly, there was a Democratic Senate working with the Reagan White House in the 1980s, and they would sit down and they'd compromise and they'd argue and they'd bicker. But at the same time, there was a recognition that there was work that needed to be done. Mitch McConnell said that he would basically change the paradigm, that he was prepared to abandon what used to be and implement a new system, which is that as far as he was concerned, he and his party would simply refuse to govern because he wanted to deny Barack Obama any victories that might help with his reelection effort.
Your book is, of course, not just about Mitch McConnell and John Boehner and other Republican leaders during the Obama administration, but your book is also about these the current Republican leaders and our current president, Donald Trump. I wonder if you could help us understand the challenge of writing about those two things, that in a sense, those two entities, because Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump are not the same beings. And even though maybe there are ways in which much of what they say might seem the same, they're two very different creatures, two very, very different backgrounds. How complicated is it to write about both of those things and to sort out, in a sense, who is responsible for what?
No, that's a very good question. It's a challenging one because as I was putting the book together, it became clear to me that different people were responsible for the problem in different ways. Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump, as you note, are very different creatures. And in fact, they've butted heads many times over the course of Donald Trump's presidency. But I try to be mindful of the broad strokes. I try to be mindful of the fact that even within a Republican Party that has a variety of different personalities and a variety of different leaders with their own different priorities and tactical concerns, I think that the party in general is moving in the same direction, despite the disparate personalities and elements within it. Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump are very different, but they agree on the importance of prioritizing politics over policy. As different as they are, I see them as, and this became clearer to me as I wrote the book, despite their differences, there's a foundation that they both find appealing, which is, so long as they're prioritizing the ideological and partisan concerns of their party, that policymaking isn't all that important, and defeating Democrats is all that really matters. As different as they are, Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump and other leaders, from Kevin McCarthy to John Thune to across the board, despite their differences, they all seem to be more or less moving in the same direction in lockstep on this fundamental point.
One of the intriguing observations you make about our current president is that because he had right from the outset so little interest in policymaking, as we think of it in standard fashion, and very little interest in preparing himself again in the way that presidents before him had. I mean, he would probably argue if he were in this conversation that he prepared exactly in the way that was right for him. But be that as it may, you write at one point, Trump's vision, such as it was in terms of his for the country, became a black box that no one, including his ostensible allies, could understand. Just talk for a moment about this image of Trump's vision as a black box and the ramifications of that in terms of his inner circle and those working in his administration.
We look back, I think voters can look back at 2016 and realize and recognize that Donald Trump had certain catchphrases that he was very fond of. But when you get right down to it and look for what was his platform, what did he promise to do in terms of governing? He didn't say. I mean, we had some basic ideas that he would cut taxes and he didn't like people of color. And we had some broad strokes understanding of what he considered sort of important. We couldn't go to his website, for example, and download his healthcare plan and then scrutinize it in a meaningful way and get a sense of how it would affect our families, our neighbors, our community. None of that was there. And in fact, Donald Trump, as I write in the book, went out of his way to say that he deliberately didn't want to do that. He made a conscious choice to tell people, I'm not going to give you the details. I will just elect me and it'll work out and it'll be fine and I'll make America great. But let's leave the details for other times for other people. That's not something that the Donald Trump campaign was going to be concerning about. It was concerned about, and that, to my mind, created a black box. We knew that there could be a Donald Trump presidency, but we didn't know what was inside of it. We didn't know what it might entail. And in fact, what I find particularly alarming right now, literally as you and I are talking, is that we're seeing that same black box appear again in the 2020 election. Right now, for example, literally just yesterday, I went to Donald Trump's website and I looked for his issues page. And then I went to Joe Biden's website and I looked for his issues page. Now on the latter, on the Democratic campaign site, I found 37 plans, an issues page with 37 plans for a variety of different issues and constituencies and problems. And you and I could debate, and others can debate, whether or not those plans have merit, whether they were good ideas or bad ideas. But at a basic level, they at least exist. We can look at them and read them and scrutinize them and determine whether or not we agree with them or not. Then I went back to Donald Trump's website and realized he didn't have an issues page. I don't know what Donald Trump wants to do in 2021 if he's in his fifth year of his presidency. And I would then look to the Republican platform to determine what is it that he and his party will find important. And I discovered that the Republican platform for 2020 is literally recycled from 2016. Because of the coronavirus and the convention schedule, they decided that they're not going to write a platform for 2020. And so to the black box point, we don't know what Donald Trump will do if he wins a second term. We just know that he wants a second term. But that's not how American politics is supposed to work. Candidates are supposed to tell us what they want to do. We determine whether or not we agree with them, and then we vote accordingly. Donald Trump is going about this in an entirely different way.
You write at one point, he was a president who assumed governing would be simple and who seemed baffled to discover that it wasn't. At another point, you write, he is a president who found it easier to guess than to govern. At one point, you say, in reality, Donald Trump did not know what he did not know.
Right.
And my question to you is, do you think he knows now what he doesn't know or didn't know? I mean, what would your guess be about that?
Right. That is a good question. I mean, because we can look at 2016 and realize that Donald Trump was a unique figure in American political history. He is the first person to win a nomination for a major party, despite having literally no background in government or public service. Never served in the military, never served in any public office at any level, at any time in his adult life. And so it was easy to discover, it was easy to notice that he did not know what he did not know. It's hard for me to speculate not knowing the president personally, but I can hope that by virtue of his now nearly 4 years in office, and the policy briefings that people have at least tried to present to him, and the interviews that he's done, I hope now that at a minimum, he's in a position to ask better questions. But if I'm being perfectly candid with you, if from what I see on his tweets and his interviews on conservative media, I get the feeling that there's not a lot of curiosity there as it relates to how government works, how policy is supposed to work, what the responsibilities of a president are. If I'm being candid, I am discouraged, and I fear that he still does not know what he does not know.
I want to make sure people understand that the bulk of your book explores many different specific areas of public policy, such as healthcare, climate change, foreign policy, immigration, federal budget, and so on. And in each of these, you examine the ways in which the Republicans have, in your mind, failed utterly when it comes to the matter of crafting policy. A last question, I wish we had more than 2 minutes for you to answer it. You write at one point, no one benefits from a two-party system in which one of the two parties no longer cares about governing responsibly. My question is, what are the ways in which the Democrats are hurt by the way that the Republican Party or its leadership is conducting itself at the moment? I mean, because I think somebody might carelessly assume that in such a scenario, the Democrats then walk away with the prize. And of course, that's not the situation. In what way is this hurting, in a sense, everybody across the board.
Right. There are two elements to this, and I'll be brief. The first is that in order for policy to happen, policymaking to happen, in order for legislation to become law, there it is built into the cake of the American government that there has to be compromise. There has to be a series of negotiations and compromises that leads to an end result. And so when Republicans are not engaged in policymaking, it does not leave the field of Democrats to do as they please. It instead leads to nothingness. And so that's the first point. And the second point is, I believe that Democrats, who are not always right, they need to be challenged, just like any governing party should. And I want a governing party to oppose them and to question their assumptions and to challenge their assumptions, to challenge their answers, to push them to be a better party. And when Republicans don't do that, it leads to complacency, it leads to laziness. I think the Democrats benefit when Republicans are pushing them to be a better party. And I think Republicans are better when Democrats pushing them to be a better party. And right now, I don't see any of that happening. And I hope that changes after November.
Is there a potential for the Democrats to be infected and to begin functioning in this same way themselves? And are we even seeing that to a point right now?
I give Democrats credit, not that they're always right because they're not, but I give them credit for taking their governing responsibilities seriously. I think that over the last couple of years, on every major issue that I can think of, they've avoided the post-policy pitfalls that I describe in my book. I hope that continues. I hope they don't look at Republicans and say, oh, well, wait a minute. If they can get away with being a post-policy party, maybe we can too. I hope they avoid those pitfalls, because if they do, then we're all in big trouble.
Well, all of this can be examined in your book called The Imposters, How the Republicans Quit Governing and Hijacked American Politics. The book is published by William Morrow and the author, Steve Bannon. Steve Bannon, I have really enjoyed this conversation. Your book gave me a great deal to think about, and I could imagine Democrats and Republicans alike and anybody who cares about this country really finding a lot to think about from reading your book. And I'm very appreciative of you for making so much time in your schedule to be part of the morning show. I thank you so much.
I'm grateful for the opportunity. I hope to be back.
Tomorrow on the morning show, I look forward to speaking with a faculty colleague from Carthage College, Dr. Gerald Mast, Associate Professor of Political Science. It's been a while since Jerry Mast has joined us, and we will have a whole lot to talk about with Professor Mast. That will be tomorrow on the morning show. We want to remind you that the morning show is available as a podcast 7 days a week. And this past weekend, I offered up a couple of very interesting interviews from the morning show archives, including on Saturday, a conversation dating all the way back to 1997 or 1998 with Carol Sabar, who continues to be a staff member at Carthage in the computer science wing of Hedberg Library. This conversation from the late 1990s with Carol Sabar was when she was explaining to me and to all of us this newfangled thing called the Internet. The Internet was still a very new presence in most of our lives. And so it's a conversation that kind of takes us back to those days when the Internet was something that a lot of us were trying to figure out. So that's a conversation you can hear on the Saturday podcast of The Morning Show. You can subscribe by going to Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Their doors may be closed, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. We're approaching 9 o'clock.